looking at only Lorenzo. 30. Lynn leaves us in the small equipment area with an excuse about wanting to check out the Tesla MRI tubes. For a woman as petite as she is, she has eyes that can bore into me like the punch of a heavyweight boxer. Be careful, those eyes say. Come with me. Lorenzo crooks a long finger and stays quiet until we're back in the biochem lab at one of the sinks. He turns the water on full blast, then leans on the black epoxy resin counter. Then he taps his right ear and looks up at the ceiling. Cameras, he mouths. I get it. If there are cameras, there are bugs as well. I lean in toward him and pretend to read the report he's taken from his breast pocket. It's a utility bill, but I focus on the page as if it's Fermat's last theorem. You told them we'd be ready in a month. Why? I say.
Because Morgan wasn't going to ask for you, or Lynn. He didn't want any women on the project. I guaranteed him we'd have a successful trial before the president left for France, but only if you two were on the team.
After a moment, he adds,
And we're already there.
I don't know whether to kiss him or slap him. You know what happens to me when we're finished, right? And to Lynn. Lorenzo looks down at my wrist, at the faded ring of an old burn encircling it.
I know.
His voice is sad, but holds an undercurrent of fury. Once again, I'm reminded of the difference between Patrick and Lorenzo. Both are sympathetic, but only Lorenzo has fight in him.
Also, I need the bonus money, he says.
For what?
A personal matter.
What kind of personal matter costs $100,000? His eyes meet mine over the running tap.
A very personal matter,
he says before turning off the water.
Okay, you feeling better now?
Sure, I say, not understanding whether he's talking about my puke fest this morning or our conversation.
Right as rain. Good, because we've got work to do.
Wait, I twist the cold water back on. When did they contact you about the project?
Just after Bobby Myers broke his head.
I nod. No one gets two Tesla MRI tubes ordered, delivered, and installed in 3 days, Enzo. Not even the government. He cracks a smile at the old nickname.
Yeah, I know. Come on. Let's dig Lynn out from her techno orgasm and grab some lunch.
The tap goes off for a second time, and we walk back to the neuro section of the lab as the clock pings one.
Who do you have in mind for the first subject?
Lorenzo asks. Definitely Delilah Ray. I saw her son the other day, you know. He's our mailman. He's also the man who blinked 3 times at me and said he had a wife and 3 daughters. I jot a mental note to be at the door the next time he makes his rounds. Right now, the only other thing on my mind is food. 31. This afternoon, as I wind along with the snake of cars on Rock Creek Parkway, hunched down behind the steering wheel to avoid the stares of the male drivers who populate rush hour, I think of Jackie Juarez again. She called Patrick a cerebral pussy. She'd never hang that epithet around Lorenzo's neck. Men come in 2 flavors, she said once. Real men and sheep. That guy you're dating is a sheep, I finished. I suppose you'd think that. I don't think it, Jeannie. I know it. Jackie lit a cigarette. She was in her Virginia Slim stage, and You've Come a Long Way, Baby Kitsch decorated our flat that year, and blew out a cloud of menthol smoke. I mean, if I were to switch over to your team, I'd want a man who, I don't know, stood up for me. Look at you, the romantic, I said. She shrugged it off. Maybe. I just want someone who was tough when he needed to be. Patrick's kind, I said. Isn't that worth something? Not in my book. When I defended my thesis and Patrick started his residency, we got married. I invited Jackie, hoping she would come. She didn't. Maybe I wouldn't have either. I pull off the parkway and stop at the light beside a middle-aged man in a matte black Corvette. Sports car menopause, I think. The back window is plastered with stickers. Myers for president. I'm sure pure, are you? And make America moral again. He honks, waits for me to turn my head, and rolls down his window. I do the same, thinking he wants directions around the labyrinthine Washington streets with their devilish diagonal avenues. He spits into my car as the light turns from red to green, then roars off. I realize I've still got the other candidate's sticker on my back bumper. What would Jackie do? Speed on after him? Probably. Spit back? Likely. What's on my mind, though, is what Patrick would do. Absolutely nothing. He'd sigh and shake his head at the barbarism, and then he'd clean up the mess of phlegm and forget about Mr. Midlife Crisis. And Lorenzo? Lorenzo would beat the living shit out of the bastard. For some reason, I find that appealing. I didn't used to. It hits me that I've turned into more of a Jackie than I expected, and suddenly I want to see her again more than anything. I doubt she wants to see me, and even if she does, Jackie's in a place where the word visitor doesn't exist. Jackie is in a camp, say it, Jean, prison, somewhere in the middle of the country, where she works on a farm, or ranch, or fish hatchery from morning to night. Her hair, whatever color it last was, shows graying roots and split ends, and her arms are red with the sunburn of a farmer's tan. A redneck tan, we used to call it, the kind that leaves your shoulders pale. She wears a wide metal bracelet that does not display any numbers because, in Jackie's new world, there are no words to count. Like the women in the supermarket, the ones with those small babies, who did nothing more than try to fingerspell a bit of gossip, a message of comfort, a mundane little, "I miss talking to you, too." Jackie Juarez, feminist turned prisoner, now sleeps at night in a cell with a man she doesn't know. I saw a documentary about these conversion camps on television last fall. Stephen had turned it on. "Freaks," he said. "Serves them right." The last of my words flew out, little daggers aimed at my oldest son, who had begun acting less like my son and more like Reverend Carl Corbin. "You don't really believe that, kiddo." He muted the television as an endless line of men and women marched from a hole in a concrete wall toward the working farm. Jeeps with armed soldiers flanked the parade of prisoners. "It's a life choice, Mom," Stephen said. "If you can choose one sexuality, you can just as easily choose another. That's all they're trying to do." I sat speechless as I watched the faces of gray-clad people, once mothers and fathers and accountants and lawyers, make their way from wall to fields. Jackie might have been among them, tired and blistered from day after day in the sun. Stephen upped the volume and pointed at a screen of statistics. "See? It's working. 10% after the first month, up to 32% as of the end of September. See?" He was referring to the conversion success rate. I didn't see at all. But I saw, and still see, Jackie Juarez in work boots and a khaki uniform, weeding and harvesting until her hands are raw and bloody. Or, Jackie is married. Maybe to a fat fuck like Jack the security man, maybe to one of the gay guys she knew before. She wears a word counter and spends her days baking and hoping to get pregnant so the authorities will know the marriage is bona fide, more than a convenient arrangement to dodge life at one of the camps. No, Jackie would never fold, never work the system, never whore herself out to the president's men in exchange for money or a voice or a month of liberty. Patrick would, of course. Lorenzo wouldn't. That was the difference between my husband and my lover. But Lorenzo did, the second he signed the contract and agreed to work on the aphasia project. As I pull into my driveway, the reason dawns on me. Lorenzo has another agenda, and I think it bears my name. 32. I put on my mother and wife face when I walk through our back door. Sonia and the twins are playing a game of cards on the den carpet. Patrick is chopping vegetables in the kitchen, an open bottle of beer next to his cutting board. I wonder if this is his first of the afternoon. Hey, I say, dropping my purse, thoroughly searched at the security checkpoint before I left the office, onto a side counter.
Hey, babe.
Patrick sets the knife down and gives me a squeeze.
Everything go okay?
Well enough.
What was it like?
We're under the pain of torture not to talk about it outside the office, I say. It's probably truer than I think. Where's Stephen? He's about to miss his 6 o'clock pre-dinner feeding. Patrick knocks his chin toward the left side of our house.
Next door.
He and Julia must be talking again, I say. You really need to speak to him about this marriage thing. He's too young.
I will. Oh, and your parents FaceTimed. I said you'd call tomorrow, but your mom wants to talk to you tonight.
Can I use your laptop?
Where's yours?
Mine is currently in quarantine with one of Poe's computer geeks. Locked up tight in a building with no name somewhere in Washington, I say. Sure I can't help in here? He flicks a dish towel at me.
Go on, git. I don't need no jive sous chefs in my kitchen.
We both laugh at his attempt at southern fry cook slang. Well, that's different. After a lightning quick round of old maid with the kids, Sonia manages a few careful words, I go to Patrick's study, which he's left unlocked, and call my parents. The Italian comes back slowly at first, then eases into a steady cadence, all vowels and rhyming syllables. Papa has nothing positive to say about the president, or the president's brother, or pretty much any part of this country. Mama is more subdued, quieter than usual.
Tutto bene, mami,
I say. She assures me everything's fine, just a few headaches recently.
You need to stop smoking, I tell her.
It's Italy, Gianna. Everyone smokes.
This much is true. Second to soccer matches, smoking is the national pastime, especially in our part of the South. I let it go for now and focus on happier talk. For a while, I listen as they tell me about the lemon and orange trees in the yard, the vegetable garden, the gossip about Signore Marco, the fishmonger, who is finally going to marry Signora Matilda, the baker. It's about time. Put together, Marco and Matilda must be 170 years old. The axe falls when Mama asks if I'm coming for a visit this summer.
You don't want me to die all alone, she says.
Nobody's dying, Mommy, I say. Still, a cold current jitters up and down my spine. Promise you'll go see Dr. Michele, okay? Between the chows and the kisses and the promises to talk again tomorrow, it takes a full 10 minutes to end the call. If the Italian women had quotas like we do, they'd spend every last word on the goodbye part of a phone conversation. Only after I've shut down FaceTime do I notice the manila envelope with its top-secret stenciling on Patrick's desk. Whoever came up with the idea of labeling classified documents with larger-than-life red stenciling that advertises, or at least hints at, the contents was a schmuck, I think. You might as well put a tag that says, "Open me," on it. If it were up to me, I'd hide all secrets in back copies of Reader's Digest. Patrick whistles in the kitchen, and the kids are now arguing over whether Sam cheated at cards by swiping one queen of spades from another deck and hiding it in his shirt sleeve. It would be so easy to take a peek at the contents of this envelope. I can practically feel the weight of that little red devil on my left shoulder, urging me on. Go ahead, Jean. Have a look. No one ever has to know. So that's what I do. The contents don't surprise me. As the president's science advisor, Patrick would, of course, be in the loop on the Wernicke project. What I don't understand is why the first page inside my husband's top-secret envelope refers to 3 separate teams, gold, red, and white. Lorenzo, Lynn, and I are on the white team. Other names, all unfamiliar to me, are listed under gold and red. A few of them have military ranks attached.
Mommy!
Sonia's voice in the doorway startles me.
I won old maid!
Now the sequestered queen of spades that Sam had makes sense. Quickly, I slide the project memo back into its envelope, hoping I've left things as they were on Patrick's desk, which always seemed to be organized with the help of a T-square. "That's super, baby girl," I say. "How about we go check on Daddy in the kitchen?"
"I love you, Mommy. I love you so much."
9 words are all it takes to make my heart skip a beat. 33.
"Anything interesting?"
Patrick says when I'm back in the kitchen. I've always been lousy at secrets. The merest hint of a lie forces my lips into a curl, then my eyes join in the game. Only once did I try to throw together a surprise party for Patrick, his 30th birthday, I think, going through his then-secretary and a couple of guys from work. When the day finally arrived, Patrick acted as stunned as if a bomb had fallen from the sky. Success, I thought. Right up until the next morning, when Evan King blabbed about what a terrific show my husband had put on.
"Saw it in your eyes, babe," Patrick said. "Good thing you're not the one with the security clearance."
So, no more surprise parties. He looks up from the stove.
"Good news?"
"What?"
"Was it good news? From your parents?"
I feel the weight of terror slide off me and melt into a puddle on the kitchen tile. I guess. Papa's sold a store to some chain, so I guess that's good news.
"Time for the old man to retire," Patrick says. "Here, taste this and tell me what it needs."
He spoons up a bit of the veg he's been sautéing. "Perfect," I say, even though it tastes off. Nothing smells good right now. The red wine Patrick pours stinks like rancid oil. The meat, which I think is chicken, but could be goat liver for all I know, fills the kitchen and dining room with a hellish stench. I should be starving, but I'm not. "Stephen's not back yet? Oh, speak of the devil." My son walks in, slamming the back door behind him. Sonia brightens, as do the twins. Patrick and I are about to say a hello, but Stephen walks past us, past the fridge, and straight down the hall toward his room. His face is flushed, a bloom of mottled red on his cheeks and neck. Somehow, he looks 37 instead of 17, the entire world on his shoulders. And here's the shittiness of parenthood, wrapped up in one sullen teenager. "I'll go," I say. I need a break from food odors before my olfactory nerves decide to rebel. "Ask Sonia to tell you about her card game." Stephen's music shakes my bones as I walk down the hall to his bedroom door. I knock once. There's no answer. On the second knock, Stephen grunts a bored, "Enter." "You okay, kiddo?" I say, sticking my nose in the doorway. Whatever he's listening to fades to dull background noise.
"Yeah,"
Stephen says.
"School go okay?"
"Yeah."
"How's Julia?"
"Fine."
"Coming out for dinner? It's almost ready."
"Soon."
I turn to go, and he breaks the chain of monosyllables.
"Mom, if someone you knew, maybe even someone you really love, did a shitty thing, would you rat them out?"
It's necessary for me to think about this. Once, I'd have said yes. See someone go 60 in a school zone, take down their license plate. Watch a parent hit his kid in the Walmart, call the cops. Witness a robbery next door, report it. For every action, there's an opposing and appropriate reaction. Except there isn't. Not anymore. The reactions might be opposing, but they sure as shit aren't appropriate. I knew about Annie Wilson and her backdoor man and his blue pickup truck, although he didn't bother using the back door. I know Lin Kwan, who now lives with her brother, is the type of woman who prefers other women. I also know that if I, in Stephen's words, had ratted Annie out, I'd have a hell of a time facing myself each morning. The idea of playing informant on Lin is anathema, whatever Reverend Carl and the rest of the pure have to say about it. "Depends," I say. "Why?"
"No reason,"
Stephen says, and hoists himself off his bed.
"Guess I should take a shower."
As he brushes past me, leaving me with the hum of electronic music, a tune from the time before, whose lyrics probably don't mesh with fundamentals of modern Christian philosophy, or pure manhood, or Carl Corbin's twisted worldview, I feel the heat of trouble settle on me again. It presses, squeezing out the air from my lungs, forcing me into a breathless state. There's no way Stephen could know about Lorenzo, I tell myself. No way. We were careful that last time, meeting accidentally at Eastern Market, driving through traffic toward our Maryland crab shack with all of me scrunched down on the floor of the back seat. It was March, and Stephen would have been in school. Fatigue and worry hit me like bags of bricks, one on each side, and I head back down the hall to join Patrick in the kitchen. He's still whistling. 34. The sirens wake me up. They're like screaming animals in the quiet of the night, growing louder and louder until it seems they're at my bedroom window. Reds and blues flicker through the blinds, and I know I'm not dreaming. "What the hell?" Patrick says, rolling over once, then twice, then pulling a pillow over his head. He doesn't last long in his cave. Reality seeps in, drawing back the curtain of sleep, and he's up. All I can think about is the conversation I had with Lynn in our office this morning. Still got a thing for our Italian colleague? How long has it been going on? Be careful, honey. You've got a lot more to lose than your voice. And then there's Stephen, his cryptic question ringing in my ears now. Oh my God, I say, and go to the window. As best I can see, there are two cars and one larger vehicle, boxy, like an ambulance, but not white. A third car pulls up behind the boxy van, blocking our driveway, blocking any cars from getting in or out. The next words I say scratch the air, hardly more than a hoarse whisper. Nothing inside me is functioning, not my knees, which have gone to jelly, not my voice, not my stomach. Wave after wave of nausea ripples through me as I stare at the electric colors lining the street in front of our house. I'm expecting the doorbell to ring. Such an ordinary event, one I used to look forward to. Doorbells meant visitors on holidays, packages I was expecting, friendly pairs of young men from Utah who, despite my resistance to any sort of conversion, somehow always seemed pleasant and well-scrubbed. Doorbells meant trick-or-treaters dressed as ghosts and goblins and the princesses or action heroes of the month. "I'll go," Patrick says. I wait for the ding of the bell and think about Poe with his scar and his ex-special forces mien and his eerie silence. They won't be silver or golden bells for me tonight, but iron ones. Oh, fuck. Now I see them coming inside, uniformed and armed with black devices, walking over the polished hardwood of my house, leaving scuffs and tracks. I see Thomas and Reverend Carl and other men, one carrying a small box with a counter set to zero that will snap on my wrist like an iron shackle. I see the television cameras and the news reporters, all flashing and straining to catch a glimpse of the former Dr. Gene McClellan, now destined to a life of silence and labor in the fields of Iowa, the fisheries of Maine, the textile mills of Alabama, subsequent to a public shaming, of course. Stephen, I think. What have you done? They won't go after Lorenzo. I know this. The follies of men have always been tolerated. Sonia comes running into my room, eyes glowing. The boys' footfalls move in the other direction, into the main part of the house, where Patrick has gone. It's okay, baby girl, I say, taking Sonia into my arms. It's okay. But it's not okay. Nothing is okay as I sit here with my back to the bed frame, rocking my daughter, waiting for the inevitable doomsday clang of the doorbell. 35. 5 horrible minutes pass before Patrick's footsteps come running back down the hallway.
It looks bad, he says. Whatever it is, it looks bad.
His face is a map of worry, all lines on a parchment-pale landscape. But the doorbell hasn't rung. I pull myself up, scoop Sonia into my arms, and follow Patrick to the kitchen. The parade of vehicles is still in the street, still screaming their sirens and polluting the night with blue and red. Six men stand guard on the front porch of the king's house, two more at the back door.
It's not me, I think. It's not me. It's not me. It's not me.
A woman's scream pierces through, all the way into our kitchen, and I risk a look out the window. Leo moves to turn on the light.
No, keep it off, keep it dark, I say.
What could Olivia King have done? If someone you knew, maybe even someone you really love, did a shitty thing, would you rat them out? And then I realize these men are here not for Olivia, but for Julia. I turn away from the window. Here's Patrick, next to me, still a ghoulish pale. Sonia, I've sat on one of the bar stools by the island. Sam and Leo stare at the scene next door through rounded eyes the size of frisbees. Only Stephen isn't here. Outside, the screaming has gotten worse. Olivia, I think it must be Olivia of the pink headscarves and pink Bibles and empty measuring cup in her hand, has unleashed pure hell.
You can't take her! Evan, do something! For fuck's sake, do something instead of standing there with your fucking hands in your fucking pockets and watching! Kill them! Shoot the motherfucking bastards! Tell them it wasn't her fault! It wasn't!
Her tirade is interrupted by a pained wail, but only for a moment, a slice of a second. Then she's back at it, half screaming, half wailing, while two men haul Julia King out of the house, while Evan stands silently by with his hands in his pockets and the porch light casting a yellow glow on his face. Before Patrick can stop me, I'm out the back door of our house, ignoring the May rain that started falling, sloshing with bare feet across our driveway and into the King's yard.
Stop it! Take her counter off! I scream.
Every head except Olivia's turns toward me. Olivia continues on, begging and sobbing now.
Please don't take her! Please, take me instead! Please!
Take the fucking counter off her! I scream again.
Go back inside, ma'am, a voice says.
I recognize it as that of Thomas of the dark suit and even darker soul. Then, to one of the others, he says,
put her in the truck.
They mean Julia, who hasn't said a word, not yet. When she turns under the wan glow of the porch light, her face is a complete blank. She's in shock. Around her left wrist is a wide metallic cuff. Julia is about to join the supermarket women, and Jackie, and God only knows how many others in their twisted version of solitary confinement. Zero words per day, girlies. Let's see how long it takes you to fall into line. I've never much cared for Olivia, but my feet take me farther into her yard, over to the bent and convulsing body in its peach satin nightgown, now sticking to her like a film, as mine is to me. From sweat, it must be, since the king's porch is covered and the rain isn't driving. Thomas motions to one of the other men, and he steps toward me, hand poised like a starfish next to the weapon on his belt.
Go home, ma'am. Nothing to see here.
But I...
The starfish hand moves an inch closer to his belt. Now I'm witnessing the single most terrible event of my life as Julia King is led from the porch, away from her mother, and toward the dark van. The man escorting her, which is really to say holding her limp frame semi-upright, reads her rights. Except they aren't rights. There's nothing that rhymes with, you have the right to. Only the monotonous repetition of phrases that all begin with, you will. My foot catches a piece of gravel as I walk back across our driveway to the rear door. There are so many pebbles, so many bits of stone, and I want to cram them by fistfuls into my eyes to blot out everything I've seen and everything I'm going to see. For instance, Patrick, standing in the kitchen, doing nothing. Stephen, who has emerged from his room by the time I drip all over the doormat and is now watching with expressionless eyes, doll's eyes, as the black van that is not an ambulance takes Julia King to her new and permanent home. Sam and Leo have brought me towels. I take them and send the twins and Sonia to bed. Then I go for the kill.
What the living hell did you do, Stephen?
He shirks away at the sound of my voice, no longer the cocky teen he was yesterday at dinner.
Nothing. What did you do?
Let go, Mom.
Right, so I have my 17-year-old son by the shirt collar now, and I'm feeling like I could squeeze and squeeze the fabric around his neck until he's ruddy and sweating. But this isn't how I want to be. This isn't the image I want to see in the mirror tomorrow morning. I lower my voice. What did you do, kiddo? Stephen seems to shrink, folding himself into the corner of the kitchen next to the fridge and the shelf that used to hold my cookbooks 1,000 or 1,000,000 years ago. My eyes slide to Patrick. I need you now, they say, these eyes of mine. I didn't, Stephen stammers. It wasn't my fault. It. What is it? An old Eartha Kitt tune hammers through my head. Let's do it. Oh, Stephen, I say. And it all spills out. She said she just wanted to make out, to try something, and... Stephen looks to Patrick for help. Finding nothing but a quiet shake of a head, he goes on. It wasn't supposed to happen. It. I make a silent promise never to use this word again. Outside, under the light of the king's porch, Evan is shouting something I can't understand while Olivia slumps against the brick wall. She'll never get over this, I say, but not to anyone in particular. Then, turning to Patrick, can you do something? Can you talk to Carl Corbin or Myers? Patrick's words are stale.
What would I say?
Christ, I don't know. You're smart. What if you told them it was Stephen's fault? That he started it and Julia said no and he went on anyway? That they were confused? Or that it didn't actually happen? There's that it again. That they didn't actually have sex. Can you do that?
That would be a lie, Stephen says, before Patrick can answer.
I don't care, I say. Do you realize what's going to happen to Julia? Do you? She comes into my vision as in an old family movie, skating or biking down the street with her halter top and her music, talking over the fence while I pruned Mrs. Ray's roses, holding Stephen's hand. Now I see her on the television, dressed in a gray smock, flinching at the flash of 100 cameras, standing silent while Reverend Carl reads out lines from his pure manifesto. Fast forward some years, and Julia is tired and bent, thin as a rail, pulling weeds or gutting fish. And no one in this room can do anything about it. Like I said, the follies of men. 36. Friday, according to my contract, is my day off, but too much adrenaline is coursing through me to sleep, so I get up, leaving Patrick to snooze, and go to the kitchen. It's where I do my best thinking. I want to fight, and I don't know how. If Jackie were here, she'd have a few words for me. Mostly, I think of one of her last lectures, that late April afternoon in our Georgetown apartment with its IKEA rugs and IKEA dishes and maybe a few pots and pans from a yard sale. You can start small, Jeannie, she said. Attend some rallies, hand out flyers, talk to a few people about issues. You don't have to change the world all by yourself, you know. And the usual catchphrases ensued. Grassroots, one step at a time. It's the little things. Hope, change, yes we can. All those words Patrick sneered at, and I sneered along with him. At 6, Stephen drags himself into the kitchen and pours a glass of milk, which he takes back to his room. Good. I can barely look at him. I fix myself some dry toast and tea. My brain wants coffee, but the rest of my body rebelled as soon as I opened the bag of beans and poured them into the grinder. Even the toast smells off, as if the entire contents of my pantry went rotten overnight. Everything tastes like old fish. Sonia's up next, full of questions about last night.
What happened at the King's house? Will I be going to play with Mrs. King today? Is Julia sick?
Her speech is like music, but the lyrics are all wrong. Everything's fine, baby. I lie. But I think Mrs. King needs a break today. Which means, of course, I'll need to find another sitter for Sonia while I'm at work. I rule out the other neighbors one by one. Too old, too religious, too weird, too careless. The last thing any of us needs is Sonia falling off a swing set or, worse, I think, coming back home reciting passages from the Pure's manifesto. I rub sleep out of my eyes and search my brain for a solution. It comes to me, all at once, that triple blink of my mailman's eyes. And he's got three girls. While Sonia's crunching on cereal, I outline my day. Make a doctor's appointment, wait for the mailman, check on Olivia as soon as Evan leaves for work, get to the office and tell Lynn what I found in Patrick's office yesterday. What I'm not planning on doing? Watching Julia King's public shaming. The program will air today and tonight, and probably for most of the next month, until there's a new victim to parade in front of the press. They always handle it this way, usually inserting the footage into some show they know people will be watching. It's sinister. No one is actually forced to watch, but the alternative is to keep your television off. And even then, reruns crop up when you least expect them. During cooking shows, This Old House, a documentary on zebras. Stephen pads back into the kitchen.
I don't feel so hot. Think I'll skip school today.
Of course he'll want to do that. Julia King will be the feature of the day at PBS.
You're not sick, Stephen, I say. So go get your brothers up and put some clothes on.
I check the clock. Bus is coming in an hour.
But Mom, just don't, kiddo.
He needs to see this program, needs to be strapped down with his eyelids forced open like that son of a bitch in the Stanley Kubrick movie. Maybe, for good measure, they'll throw in a few clips of Julia's future life in the fields or fisheries. The phone rings as I'm rinsing dishes. Get that for me, please. Then wake Sam and Leo. I turn to Sonia. How about you go check on your daddy? You can bring him this if you're careful. I hand her a half-filled coffee mug, wincing a little at the stench. Never before did it occur to me how much coffee smells like shit.
Okay,
Sonia says, and goes off, holding the mug with both hands, walking at a snail's pace. With any luck, Patrick will get his coffee sometime in the next week.
It's for you, Stephen says. It's Bobo. It kills me, this pet name for his grandfather, a childish holdover from a time when my son was Sonia's age, when he was still running around in bright red corduroy pants and a sun-yellow t-shirt with the words Super Kid blazoned across the front. I have a clear memory now of us in this kitchen before the remodeling job, when the appliances were still avocado and gold-flecked white formica covered the countertops. I was making a batch of brownies, and Stephen, rather than asking for the spoon to lick, pulled the empty batter bowl toward him, using his tiny hand as a spatula.
Why do they have to grow up so goddamned quickly? I take the receiver. It's my father.
Hi, Papa. How come you're calling on the phone instead of FaceTiming?
Whatever answer he has for this, I don't hear it. My father is crying hoarsely, and the background noise of Italian hospital sounds filters through the phone line.
Papa, what's happened?
I say. A new voice replaces his.
Professora Magalella,
a woman asks, only she pronounces Patrick's un-Italian surname as Magalella, avoiding clusters and codas, turning it into something familiar to her. Yes? Tea and toast begin an obnoxious roiling in my stomach. What is it? It again. Everything has become one looming it.
Your mother,
the doctor says after introducing herself. Her English is good, good enough that I don't have to worry about medical jargon in a language I haven't used for more than a year.
Your mother had an aneurysm. It burst early this morning.
My tea and toast climb up farther into my chest. Locus, I say.
In her brain,
the doctor says. Yes, I know that. I mean where in her brain. I have some background in neurology.
In the posterior section of the superior temporal gyrus.
Left or right, I ask, already knowing the answer. Papers rustle over the phone.
Left hemisphere.
I lean forward on the counter, my head pressed against the cool of the granite.
Wernicke's area,
I whisper.
Yes, near the area of Wernicke.
Another blast of Italian comes over the phone, drowning out the doctor's words.
I'm sorry, I really am sorry, but I have another patient to attend to. If you can call back in a few hours, we might know more about your mother's situation.
She puts my father back on the line. Is she conscious? I ask.
No.
When we disconnect, I'm left with Jackie's words. One step at a time, Jeannie. Start small. I don't know how to start, big or small, but I know whatever I do next needs to be huge. I wish Jackie were here. 37. Everyone except Sonia is out of the house when the mailman's truck pulls up. He dodges puddles on the way to our mailbox, sifting through the stack of envelopes in his courier bag.
Morning, Dr. McClellan, he says.
Good morning, I say.
Aw, don't waste your words on the likes of me, ma'am. I'll understand.
I hold up my wrists.
Temporary reprieve, courtesy of the president's brother. I don't get you.
I'm back at work, and we'll be needing subjects for our clinical trials. He processes this.
Well, that's some fine news. Can I tell Sharon? That's my wife.
Sure.
She'll be so happy. My ma always treated Sharon like one of her own.
His face darkens.
I know she'll have to wear one of those counters, but still, 100 words a day is better than nothing, right?
I guess it is, I say, unsure whether I agree. I'm trying to read the return addresses on the envelopes he's carrying, but he's holding them close. Do you think your wife might want a babysitting job? I've got a little girl, and the people who are watching her, well, they're unavailable.
I think we can work something out.
He lifts the metal flap and peers inside the locked box.
Ah, outgoing mail today. Just a sec.
From the ring of keys on his belt loop, he takes a newish-looking silver one, with teeth in a pattern I haven't seen before, except on the set of keys Patrick carries around. The box hinges open, and he takes out a single envelope, carefully covering with his palm the area where the address would be. He locks the mailbox again and, almost as an afterthought, lets the letters in his hand slide through the metal mouth.
You pure Dr. McClellan?
He asks, blinking his eyes 3 times before raising them to the camera trained on our front door. A reminder. I shake my head. It isn't much of a shake, only a slight move to the right and the left. Slow but definite, enough to get the message across. He says.
Well, let me call the wife and see what we can do about taking care of your girl. What's her name?
Sonia.
Pretty name.
He speaks a few words into his watch, which beeps once when he's finished.
Sharon, darling, I got that lady doctor here in AU Park who needs a little help with her baby girl. How about I send her on over to the house in a while?
Another beep, and he ends the call.
Heh heh. Blink once for yes, twice for no, remember?
I have 0 idea what he's talking about.
Okie dokie. I best get on with my route. When you see Sharon, you tell her I said I'll be home a little late today. Gotta take an extra shift, make a bit more jingle, keep the home fires burning and all that garbage. Know what I mean?
Sure, I say, although I'm beginning to think Mr. Mailman and I speak mutually incompatible languages.
And I'll make sure I leave my number for you, so we can set up Mrs. Ray's appointment.
He scribbles on a scrap of glossy advertising flyer.
Hate these things. Everybody hates the Valpaks. Can't stop them, though. Anyway, here's the address. Sharon will be expecting you.
I take the folded scrap from his hand. Thanks. Be in touch soon. And he's off, back down the gravel driveway, dodging puddles and whistling to himself. It's a curious whistle, not really a song, but tuneful all the same, and there's a touch of familiarity in it. When I get inside, Sonia is still watching her cartoon. No, honey, let's turn this off for a while.
No!
She squeals. There she is, Julia King, up on the screen in the time it takes me to locate the remote. She's in a drab gray smock, long-sleeved and down to her ankles, even in this heat, and her hair is cut, which I don't remember them doing to Annie of Mr. Blue Pickup Truck fame, but maybe they've changed something, introduced a new brand of humiliation into their ritual. Reverend Carl stands beside her, sober and sad, and begins reciting the relevant bits from the Pure's manifesto.
Look you not on your own self, but on others, as Christ did in taking upon himself the form of a servant, obedient unto death, even the death of the cross.
And,
if you suffer for righteousness's sake, happy are you, for it is better, if the will of God be so, that you suffer. For this affliction, which endures but for a moment, is your key to eternal light and glory in the kingdom of heaven.
Blah, 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 blah. Sonia sits up, even more attentive than she was when the cartoons were on.
Julia?
She says. I lie. No, just a girl who looks a little like her. And I click the television off as Reverend Carl begins another of his rants. Come on, let's get you ready. We're going to see some new friends today. I do three things. First, get Sonia to brush her teeth for more than 5 seconds. Then I run to my own bathroom and spill toast and tea into the toilet. Then I unfold the scrap of advertising material my mailman gave me and read. There's an address. Also, a note. Don't be too surprised. 38. Sharon Ray's house is more barn than actual house, a weathered wood structure that looks as if someone has beaten it with a giant ugly stick. I follow twin dirt ruts from the road, past a vegetable garden the size of a small farm, and kill the engine behind a Jeep with vanity plates. The Virginia tags read, Impure. Sonia unstraps herself from the car seat and vaults out in the direction of two goats.
Whoa, little girl, wait a minute, I say.
In the 45-minute drive out here, I explained that the girls she's about to spend her day with might not talk very much. Just like school, I said. Remember that. But then, of course, the Ray girls would be at school on a Friday. A screen door, tilted on its hinges, swings open, and Sharon steps out onto a porch that isn't quite parallel to the ground. She's in frayed overalls and a checked cotton shirt. A blue bandana tied on her head with the knot on top keeps her hair in check, but doesn't cover it. Ropes of muscle line her forearms, where the shirt cuffs are rolled back, and in one hand, she's holding a wrench. In the other, a plastic drywall bucket. Sharon Ray could be a modern Rosie the Riveter, if Rosie had been 40-something, black, and wearing a silver-toned word counter on her wrist. She smiles from the porch, sets the bucket and wrench down, and walks to where Sonia and I are standing. Then she tilts her head slightly to the right, toward an outbuilding that seems to be in better repair than the family's house. We walk in silence to the barn, Sonia wide-eyed at goats and chickens and three alpacas roaming freely around the property.
What's that?
Sonia says, pointing toward one of the furry beasts. Shh, I say. Sharon smiles again, but says nothing until we've reached the barn. She slides a wooden beam as thick as a man's thigh aside and pushes the door open. Smells of sweet hay and not-so-sweet manure hit me like a slap.
Nothing like a little horse shit to wake you up, is there? Sharon says. Sorry, I mean poo. I forget myself sometimes.
It's okay. I've never been one to mince words around my kids.
So, you're Sonia?
She bends down and takes my daughter's left hand, running a thumb where Sonia's wrist counter should be.
I'm Ms. Sharon, and I think we're gonna be good friends, you and me. You like horses?
Sonia nods.
Use your words, girl. You got 'em, right?
I told her, I start.
You're probably wondering why I'm talking so much.
Sharon unsnaps the silver band on her left wrist and slides it off.
Fake. Dell made it for me last year, once he figured out how to get the real one off. Made three more for our girls.
She turns back to Sonia, as if nothing she just said could possibly be more interesting than livestock.
So that one in the back, he's Cato. Next to him is Mencken, and that bull-headed roan mare over on the side is Aristotle. How about you go say hello to them while I talk to your mama?
Sonia doesn't need to be asked twice and runs off toward Aristotle's stall.
She won't bite, will she? I say, nodding to the mare.
Not unless I tell her to, Sharon says.
You look surprised, Dr. McClellan.
Jean, I guess I am.
Dell's an engineer in mailman's clothing. Got things all set up here, so it looks like we're following along, nice and quiet-like. Good man, my Dell, even if he is a white boy from town. Come on over here and I'll show you something.
She leads me past Cato and Mencken, odd names for horses, I think, not as odd as naming a mare after a classical male philosopher, and opens a door at the back of the barn. Dell's workshop is both a science lab and the antithesis of any lab I've ever seen. Most of the machinery looks as if it were cobbled together from spare game console parts and kitchen equipment. On my right is an old slide projector that has been gutted. On my left, on a clean work table, are five CPUs from the 1980s, their insides arrayed neatly in rows.
What does he do in here? I ask.
He tinkers.
Why?
Sharon stares at me.
Why do you think? Take a good look at me, Jean. I'm a black woman.
I noticed.
So?
So how long do you think it's gonna be before Reverend Carl and his holy, pure blue sheep get it in their heads that it ain't just women and men who were made differently under God's eyes, but blacks and whites? You think mixed marriages like mine are part of the plan? If you do, you're not as smart as I thought.
I feel myself going red.
I never thought about it.
Course you never. Look, I don't mean to be unkind, but you white gals, all you're worried about is, well, all you're worried about is you white gals. Me? I got more to fret over than whether I have 100 words a day. I got my girls, too. We still send them to that school and do what we can on the weekends until we can figure out a way to get out of here and over the border, but Dell and I know a tide's coming in. I guess before the year's out, we'll start seeing more than just separate schools for boys and girls. And just like now, they ain't gonna be equal.
There's no emotion in her voice, no self-pity, only cold, clear observation, as if she were reciting a recipe or reporting the weather. I'm the one who's sweating.
Anyway, Sharon says, opening up a cooler and taking out a handful of fat carrots.
She feeds them to the horses, showing Sonia how to hold one hand out, palm up, so the beasts can take the carrot without taking the hand along with it.
Anyway, how about you go off to work, and Sonia and I will do a little farming. Any idea when this magic potion of yours might be ready? I'd like to talk to my mother. Well, Dell's mother, but she's the only one I've got now.
Yeah, so would I. I explain about Mama and her aneurysm.
Looks like you and me are in the same barrel of pickles, Jean,
Sharon says, and takes Sonia by the hand.
I don't envy your position, though. You get the cure done, that little bracelet goes back on. You don't, and your mama keeps babbling. One or the other. One choice to a customer, as my daddy used to say.
I could set something up for early next week. Maybe Tuesday?
That'd be real nice.
We exchange numbers, and Sharon tells me Dell will call over the weekend, if that's okay.
Meanwhile, she says, you don't say anything about our little talk here, all right? Dell's got a lot to lose with him being the errand boy for the resistance. I don't want him in trouble, or anyone else.
There's a resistance? The word sounds sweet as I say it.
Honey, there's always a resistance. Didn't you go to college?
As we walk back to the house, the woman beside me seems more and more like Jackie. I imagine her carrying posters and organizing sit-ins while I stayed home with my nose in a book, or while Patrick and I went out for cheeseburgers and rolled our eyes at the latest campus protest. Sharon, even with her mud-caked boots and torn overalls, makes me feel dirty.
I'll pick her up at 6, if that's not too late, I say, before kissing Sonia goodbye.
That's fine. We'll be here.
On the way to my doctor's appointment, I think of Dell, my mailman, running errands for some underground group of anti-pure people, and I laugh. They would use a mailman. 39. It's official. I'm pregnant. The gynecologist who stepped into Dr. Claudia's place at the clinic tells me I'm about 10 weeks along, give or take a few days. You never really know exactly when conception happens, he says, before giving me a sealed envelope addressed to Patrick. It contains the date of my next appointment, some general literature, a schedule, and other information I might find useful. This is what he tells me. My words tumble out like a geyser. What if there are complications, unexpected pain? What if I need to describe symptoms? All I can think about is what will happen when the counter goes back on. What I don't say is, what if I don't want this baby? I already know the answer. Dr. Mendoza waits for me to finish, eyes calm, mouth drooping slightly at the edges. I can't tell whether this outburst of mine annoys him or invokes sympathy. Mrs. McClellan, he begins. Not doctor, not professor, Mrs. Mrs. McClellan, you're a healthy woman, and we've picked up a strong, regular heartbeat. We've marked you as advanced maternal age, yes, which would worry me if this was a first pregnancy. But it isn't. You have nothing to worry about. I'm confident you'll carry to term, and let's see. He pauses, spins some dials on that little wheel doctors use, even though they have computers to do the work. Deliver a fine baby around December 20th of this year. A nice Christmas present. I don't want a fine baby around December 20th of this year. I don't want a baby at all, especially if it's a girl. Dr. McClellan will have all the information. He taps the sealed envelope. He'll be on the lookout for signs of trouble, loss of appetite, changes in skin tone or weight, and so forth. And we'll be monitoring your progress regularly. If you like, I can set up a chorionic villus sampling for you early next week. You'll find out the sex then. The doctor consults a schedule on his iPad. How is Monday afternoon? I nod. Monday, Wednesday, next month, December 20th. I might as well find out sooner. Now he taps my knee, a fatherly tap, or the kind of touch you'd use on a well-behaved dog. I wish the tap would send my foot shooting out and upward, smack into his groin. I could always say it was an involuntary reflex, a spasm.
Okay. All set. Congratulations, Mrs. McClellan.
He leaves, and I rush into my underwear, jeans, blouse. The smell of latex and hand sanitizer in this room has become unbearable. My sex is slippery with KY jelly, or whatever they use for the ultrasound, because I didn't take the time to wipe it away. But I can't breathe here. I can't breathe at all. I drive the long way back home, stopping at a 7-Eleven to pick up a pack of Camels. I could smoke it out of me, I think, poison the little palace, practice teratology 101 in the privacy of my own home, abortion the old-fashioned way. An abortion is not an option. It isn't just Reverend Carl and his pack of pure fanatics. They have to put limits on choice for other reasons, for pragmatic reasons. The way things are, the way women are, no one would want a girl. No sane parent would want to choose a wrist counter color for a 3-month-old. I wouldn't. In 3 days, I'll know if I have to. 40. By the time I arrive at work, Lorenzo and Lynn are in the lab, heads together, arguing over protein extractions and whether we need to add a primate to the menagerie of lab animals. We don't. I say. What we need to do is check out the second MRI room. There's no reason to check the MRI equipment. Lynn has already done that. But I've been around the machines enough and heard one subject after another complain about the banging, even with ear protection. Lying in an MRI tube is like snuggling up next to the amp while Eddie Van Halen wails out a guitar solo. In other words, almost painful. When we're all in the room, I fire up the machine. The force of some 60,000 times the Earth's natural magnetic field shakes my bones. I tell them, above 125 decibels of ear-splitting noise, about my mother and about the envelope I found in Patrick's office last night.
Three teams? Lynn shouts. Are you sure?
Positive, I yell back. My voice is barely audible, but Lynn gets it.
Anyway, we're done. I have all the numbers at home, and I want to set up the first trial on Mrs. Ray for Tuesday. Monday, if we can manage it. It means we'll have to work through the weekend, dose up a few mice. I mean, Lynn can-